Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for today's Ask the Procurement Executive call. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm the Communication Director for USAID's Office of Acquisition Assistance and USAID's Industry Liaison. Sorry for a little bit of a delay in getting started this morning. We just had to get into a conference room and get our computers and everything set up. Just for the little bit of overview of today's call, so this is the purpose of the Ask the Procurement Executive call is to try and help address some of the topics and questions that are important to how improving how we do business together with our partners. I will say if you're a new partner to USAID, this may be a little bit more technical than something that you're familiar with, but that's okay. As you start getting funding from USAID, some of these issues will probably become much more relevant to you because we understand that working with USAID and obviously with the federal government is sometimes complex with all the different rules and requirements. I would like to start off by thanking all of the partner associations that we work with to organize this call. Humentum, Interaction, the Small Business Association of International Development Companies, the Society for International Development Washington Chapter, and the Professional Services Council of International Development Companies. We reached out to these organizations. They polled all of their different members and provided us with the questions that we'll be covering on today's call. So during today's call, the call probably about 45, 50 minutes long, we'll be going over, I think, 14 questions that were submitted to us from these associations. I think we received around 38 or 37 questions total, and we will actually be posting the full list of questions and responses on our website later today. If you Google USAID Ask the Procurement Executive, you'll find that page. Once we do get the questions posted and responses posted, we'll also post a recording of this call as well as the transcript of this call on our website for you to access. We'll send a note out through our acquisition assistance email distribution list, which all of you are probably already on because that's how we notified you of this event, and also sharing it on our Twitter handle, which is at USAIDBizOps. Just on today's call, you'll be hearing a number of different voices, so I want to briefly introduce everyone that will be speaking before we dive into the call. So first, we're pleased to have Mark Walther, who's USAID's Senior Procurement Executive and Director of the Office of Acquisition Assistance. We have Tanisha Alston, who's USAID's Small Business Goaling Manager, who's from USAID's Office of the Small and Disadvantaged Business Utilization, or OSDBU. We have Deb Broderick, who's a Deputy Director in our Office of Acquisition Assistance, and Randy Tift, who's a Senior Advisor in our Office of Acquisition Assistance. So before we dive into the Q&A, though, I want to ask Mark to provide a couple of introductory remarks.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. And again, I want to share my thanks with each and every one of you for being on the call today, and add my thanks to the associations that Matt highlighted. We very much appreciate your support in helping us to identify questions and topics that are important to you, our partners. We are committed to continuing to improve how we do business. These calls are an important part of our efforts to understand the pain points and different questions that many organizations are facing when working with our agency. To kick off the call, I'd like to highlight a number of items that we are continuing to work on as we implement the acquisition and assistance strategy, the ANA strategy. First, our ANA labs are in the process of developing a number of toolkits that will help support our staff in the implementation of the ANA plan. These toolkits include guidance around co-creation, adaptive partnering, performance-based approaches, and broad agency announcements. On the policy front, we've updated ADS 303 to include a number of items such as the introduction of renewal grants, revised guidance around substantial involvement, and streamlined the eligibility process and reforms around extensions and follow-ons. We are now working on changes to ADS 302. In addition, we are working with our Bureau for Policy Planning and Learning, PPL, to help strengthen the role of contracting and agreement officer representatives, the CORs and AORs in our agency. We are also actively recruiting contracting and agreement officers, including the current job announcement on usajobs.gov for foreign service contracting officers. So please feel free to share that with your colleagues. We're always looking for the best talent out there, so thank you for that. We're continuing to promote the new partnerships initiative, NPI, in the agency. As many of you will likely know, we are working with a handful of overseas offices to pilot mission NPI plans. As part of these plans, missions will be identifying new and existing opportunities to engage with organizations that are new and underutilized, advance co-creation, and strengthen local capacity. We have been in the process of updating our business forecast for the second quarter. You should see a note seeking your questions on the business forecast in the next few days. We will plan to host a similar call to this in mid-March, focused on the updated business forecast. In a few weeks, a number of us will be traveling to Frankfurt to participate in the second overseas U.S. Small Business Conference, which Tanisha will highlight in greater detail. We're looking forward to meeting many of you there as well. Finally, we are also planning the release of our fiscal year 2019 progress report, which highlights all the activities that we have achieved in the acquisition and assistance space, and that slices and dices various lenses of A&A data. There is a lot happening here at USAID, and we understand that all of these activities have an impact on you. Again, please accept our commitment to keeping these lines of communication open. If you have any questions, you can also feel free to raise them with Matt Johnson, our industry liaison.
Thanks, Mark. I want to turn the call over now to Tanisha. Many of you know that work with us, our Office of Acquisition Assistance. We work closely with our small business office, and we're pleased that they're able to join us for this call and all of our other engagements. So, Tanisha, do you want to give us a couple of updates what's happening with the small business office at USAID?
Sure. Thanks, Matt. Good morning, everyone. As you may already know, fiscal year 2019 was another exceptional year for USAID in partnering with small businesses. The acquisition data indicates we awarded approximately $784 million to small businesses out of a total portfolio of $5.4 billion in prime contracts. This translates to approximately 14.60% in direct awards to small businesses, which exceeds our fiscal year 2019 small business goal of 12.5%. The agency's dollars to small businesses increased by more than $100 million from 2018 to 2019. In addition, we exceeded our small disadvantaged business goal for the 10th consecutive year. We awarded $387.6 million, or 7.17% to those small businesses. For the first time since fiscal year 2014, we exceeded our women-owned small business goal of 5% by awarding approximately $297.7 million, or 5.5% to women-owned small businesses. There were other notable increases in the remaining socioeconomic programs, such as HUBZone and Service Disabled Veterans. Maintaining our level of excellence in partnering with U.S. small businesses continue to be an ongoing commitment both in Washington and in the field. For this reason, we have extended our small business goaling program to all missions that have an average of $5 million in acquisition dollars over the past three fiscal years. We will post a list of participating missions when we complete the process. We have posted the small business accomplishments of the missions that have participated in the small business goaling program during fiscal years 2018 and 2019. Lastly, I'd like to say that we are 20 days away from our second overseas small business conference in Frankfurt, Germany. As of today, more than 250 U.S.-based small businesses have registered to attend this event. My director, Mauricio Vera, has been working very closely with leadership of the Middle East Regional Platform in Frankfurt, Germany, our mission in Ukraine, and the Bureau for Management Office of Acquisition Assistance in Washington to plan this event. I wish to send a special thank you to Matthew Johnson, the agency's industry liaison, who's been very instrumental in helping us planning this event. The event represents another internal collaborative effort to focus on the program and priorities and procurement needs for the missions of Europe, Eurasia, Middle East, and Africa Bureau. And with that, I hope to see all of you there. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Tanisha. So what we want to do now is dive into the questions that we received from the partner associations. Like I mentioned earlier on the call, those of you who are just joining us now, we received around 37 or 38 questions total from all of the different associations. And on the call today, we're going to cover about 14 questions. And we'll be posting the responses to all the questions we received on our website later this afternoon. And so, Mark, I want to turn over the first question to you, questions related to performance work statements. So the question was, can USAID provide clear and consistent instructions when a performance work statement is used for a technical approach of proposals? Specifically requirements for language that does not identify the applicant or their partner organization. In the absence of clear instructions, the partner says it's difficult to demonstrate experience in partnerships that are foundational to the design of approaches and interventions.
Thanks, Matt. First, there are numerous sources available on performance work statements out in the federal government, and there's the most important takeaway really has two mandatory features, which are one, the work is stated in terms of outcomes or results rather than methods of performance, and two, that measurable performance standards and the methods of assessing contractor performance against those standards. The contracting officer of the performance work statement would be able to provide clear and consistent instructions regarding their various requirements under their solicitation. We are attaching one source that folks can get assimilated with and started as far as the PWS and the statement of objectives. However, if an RFP is unclear or inconsistent regarding PWS instructions, we do request that you ask for the clarification of the contracting officer during the RFP process. Each RFP is somewhat of a unique proposal instructions, and questions relating to clarity or inconsistency should be at least initially addressed with the contracting officer. As we go through these questions this morning, though, I would like to highlight, you know, if you are seeing a variety of areas where there is inconsistent understanding and or needs of greater clarity, we're more than welcome to try to take deeper dives into specific areas, but there are some areas where there are a variety of different approaches one could take.
Thanks, Mark. The next question for you is just dealing with staffing overall. Obviously, partners are noticing sort of increased use of smaller awards to smaller and medium-sized organizations. Sort of how is USAID managing, you know, such a what looked like to be an increased workload and increased procurement oversight with this new focus?
Sure. And the administrator has approved the hiring of both civil service and foreign service contracting officers. The agency has recognized the need that we to increase our acquisition and assistance workforce to responsibly manage the developing humanitarian program. In the short to medium term, we are asking Foreign Service Contractors officers to actively support each other to balance workload globally across traditional boundaries. So looking at different regional approaches into the, in addition to the bilateral approaches in each country to help support one another. While some centralization of support services is inevitable during the current staffing postures, supporting each other across the country and regional boundaries will help ensure that we preserve bilateral support as a proven model that delivers the best development results and the most development impacts. We still also provide TDY support to the field. We also have Foreign Service Nationals come to Washington to join us and support us through the third and fourth quarter. So we are very much proactive in trying to manage workload as well as to have a more strategic posturing overall.
Thank you, Mark. The next question is related to the performance review. I'd say it's the most popular question we received from all of our partners. And so in 2019, USAID revised ADS 303 to include a new requirement for agreement officer representatives to prepare a performance review for each assistance award within 45 days of its completion. Does USAID plan to issue further guidance on these or other aspects of the performance review process soon? I think the members just know they'd appreciate more guidance and information on that process overall.
Sure. I'd just like to take a brief minute to provide a little bit more background. One of the key pillars in effective partnering and procurement reform, EPPR, is performance management and how we can do that more effectively. And we have been pursuing those goals. Concurrently with those efforts, the Office of the Inspector General also undertook an award management audit that found a variety of different inconsistencies as far as individual performances under awards and how individual firms were then rated. And there seemed to be no correlation between the actual performance of meeting targets, meeting indicators, or not meeting them with the ultimate performance score that they received. As part of that award management audit, we did also connect with OMB. As many of you know, there is no federal-wide system, and OMB did not want us to undertake cost in the development of a new system for assistance instruments, grants, and cooperative agreements. On the other side, the flip side, well, there is an existing system, CPARs and PEPRs, for contracts It was equally noted to us that that is strictly an acquisition-based system. It cannot be used for grants and cooperative agreements. So this is the background as far as what led up to the initiation of a kind of assistant reviews in regard to risk and performance. This is our first foray in this area. This is an initial step. Obviously, we'll welcome and entertain additional thoughts as we move forward in the years ahead and see how the agency progresses compared with the rest of the federal government. We've only introduced this on an end of an agreement basis. It's not annually like it is on the acquisition side. So just more specifically, you know, the review and evaluation of the recipient's performance and the requirements to review risk posed by applicants, in one sense, is not a new requirement. As part of the review of federal awarding agencies, agencies may consider, quote unquote, the applicant's record in managing federal awards. If it is a prior recipient of federal awards, including timeliness and compliance with applicable reporting requirements, conformance to the terms and condition of previous federal awards, and if applicable, the extent to which previously awarded amounts will be expended prior to future awards. And this can all be found in CFR 200.05. The agency, in its efforts, has mandated the use of a template, a performance review template, for assistance agreement officers and their representatives to collect information to assess risk, again, at the end of an award. This serves as a risk-based approach in evaluating risk of proposed applicants. It allows agreement officers and their representatives to assess recipient performance information in a timely manner. The agreement officers and their representatives can access and use this information for future risk assessments of the recipient or applicant. In addition, the form may serve as a step toward broader federal efforts in the government for government-wide goals and consistency and shared performance data. As always, again, we welcome thoughts in this area, and we continue to work on greater clarity and so forth as we continue to move forward in this space.
Thanks, Mark. And I do just want to note, I think one of the questions we received is related to whether or not the template is available for our partners to see. We just posted the template for performance reviews on our website this morning. So if you go to our website under resources for partners, on the right-hand column, you'll see a link that says additional resources. You'll see the template there just for your review, for your information. We'll also include the link to that document in the transcript of this call. And so you can see what that performance review template looks like that we're giving out to the CORs or AORs. Next question, Deb, I want to turn it over to you, and it's related to the single submission of single audit reports to the Federal Audit Clearinghouse for non-U.S. recipients. So the question is, does this requirement apply only to instances where non-U.S. recipient is a direct recipient of USAID funds? And then the second part of that question, are primes able to submit reports of any non-U.S. sub-recipients to USAID for review?
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, so this requirement is to submit audit reports through the Federal Audit Clearinghouse only applies to U.S.-based recipients who have prime awards with USAID. The requirement does not apply to non-U.S. recipients at all. It's only for U.S. recipients. And no, the second part of the question, no, primes are not able to submit the reports of non-U.S. subrecipients to USAID for review because this is the prime recipient's responsibility to review the subawardee's reports and resolve any audit findings.
Thanks, Deb. Another question for you. Obviously, you're the agency's competition advocate, so this is a question related to some non-competition. The question is, our members would appreciate greater clarity on the factors scrutinized by USAID when NGOs employ non-competitive procurement options. Would USAID consider issuing more guidelines on their interpretation of the four non-competitive procurement options and what their expectation is of NGOs for adequately documenting the use of these options? For instance, if an NGO determines a needed service is only available from one consultant, what level of scrutiny would USAID apply and what factors do they look at?
Okay, so the agency follows 2 CFR 200.320 and does not have additional guidance on this topic. So, and there's reasons for that. If there are, so let me just caveat that by saying if there are specific issues that are being encountered, we would encourage the organization to engage directly with their CO or AO. And also, if this question relates to large inconsistencies, then please let us know and we can look at it more broadly. But on a specific case-by-case basis, to address that, specifically to the question of non-competitive options, what I would say is a compelling justification is what is required to meet these requirements in 2 CFR 200. So it has to be something that you, when you read it, you feel compelled. In other words, there was no other option. So when we do a justification to restrict or to limit competition, I'm looking at it to determine, is it persuasive? Is it compelling? And so, for example, did they do market research? Before you can tell me that there are no sources, you'd have to know that what the market looks like. So to say that there was just no market research done would not make it a very compelling answer. So each case is specific. What I would say is procurement by non-competitive proposals is procurement through the solicitation of a proposal from limited sources. So it's not always a sole source. It could be limited when one or more of the following circumstances apply. And I was just going to list the four. So you should identify which of the four exceptions you are using. The item is available from only one single source. Or two, the public exigency or emergency for the requirement doesn't allow or permit competitive solicitation. The federal awarding policy, the federal awarding agency or pass-through entity expressly authorizes non-competitive proposals in response to a written request from the non-federal entity, or after solicitation of number of sources, competition is determined inadequate. So those are the four exceptions. You should identify which one it is, and it should be a compelling response.
Thank you, Deb. Next question is for you, Mark. This organization noted in recent requests for proposals and requests for proposals, they've witnessed a shift by USAID from a scoring assignment point values methodology for evaluating technical proposals to a qualitative methodology that does not use a point system and in some cases relies on a level of confidence judgment. Can you please clarify the process by which missions and operating units are determining the evaluation methodology for a particular technical proposal? How does the agency ensure a fair evaluation of offers proposals when using qualitative methodologies? And these can be seen as more subjective than qualitative methods.
Thanks, Matt. First, our agency does not have statistics per se on the various evaluation methodologies being utilized by the different missions and here in Washington. It could be points, it could be adjectival, it could be a combination thereof, and there are others throughout the federal government. It is possible, though, here at our agency that particular COs or technical offices are utilizing specific methodologies more frequently or more consistently, like adjectival ratings. There is no mandatory policy or stated preference on the methodology to be used, as one method is not considered inherently better than the other per se. As long as the requirements of FAR 15 are met, the agency ensures that the requirements of FAR 15 utilizing best value as described therein to design competitive acquisition strategies suitable for specific circumstances of the acquisition. We also do have agency templates and guidance to our technical colleagues, and adjectival ratings is included in there and definitions. So we do have tools that are available to our contracting and agreement officers in this space.
And similar, we will link to some of those tools in the transcript from this call that has a link to some of those tools and resources just for those of you that want to dive a little bit deeper into it. Mark, the next question for you as well, and it's related to CFAR scores. This organization commented they've heard from multiple CEOs that they're being pressured to lower CPAR scores, particularly to satisfactory ratings, or to stop giving exceptional ratings. Does the agency have any guidance on this topic that has gone out to COs or CORs? When we've received exceptional or very good in the past, then the comments are essentially the same as what they are now for satisfactory. It appears that we are not performing to the past high quality, which is not the case. This is not only important for the management of the current project, but also critical to past performance reviews in the bid process.
No, thanks, Matt. First, I'd just like to indicate there's no pressure coming from Washington in regard to the narrative and the scoring of individual scores and lowering of scores. What we are emphasizing is ensuring that the standards that are applicable across the federal government in the different categories as provided in the systems and as trained to are more appropriately understood and complied with. But there is no pressure, et cetera, to dictate a particular score or level. I mentioned earlier the award management audit that was undertaken by the OIG. It was entitled USAID's Award Oversight is Insufficient to Hold Implementers Accountable for Achieving Results. And it concluded that USAID does not adequately adhere to CPAR's rating process. Further, the OIG also called CPAR's ratings that were submitted questionable. The OIG stated none of the sampled acquisitions award received a rating less than satisfactory. On average, it was 4 or very good, regardless of their performance. For example, one implementer received satisfactory ratings despite the CO indicating that the services rendered did not meet USAID standards and the award had to be extended twice to improve the quality of work. The IG went on to observe that programs that failed to achieve results generally rated higher than those that did achieve 100% of desired results, and that the two worst performing programs audited received satisfactory ratings. These findings and a desire to strengthen the agency's partner base prompted USAID to do a hard reset on CPARs and its use in evaluating performance. Enhanced and now mandatory training on CPARs is designed to ensure that ratings are more in line with federal standards and that performance can be assessed objectively across the agency. It is possible, then, that shifts in rating any one partner may observe may not be the results of shift in that partner's own performance, but rather reflective of broader standardization and ratings across the agency. Again, our goal here is to make sure individual agreement officers and their representatives, individual contracting officers and their representatives understand the standards, the federal standards, and that apply them in a more consistent basis across the board.
Thanks, Mark. Deb, the next question is for you as related to the biodata form. The question is, has guidance or training been provided to mission and USAID contracting officers regarding the new biodata form and determining compensation? If so, it would be helpful if this could be shared so that partners can understand the parameters that they're working with.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. So we held a worldwide conference call for our staff when we issued the new form. We also shared the full list of questions we received from the partner community with all of our staff. Given that we removed the consistent data element, salary history, it's probably not surprising that there's some inconsistency. The determination of the rate is within the CO's discretion after considering the market, among other factors, and may include salary history. So we recognize that there's still some angst about this, and we are collecting input from our ANA staff and plan to provide a webinar in the future to cover any remaining questions on this topic. We will also engage the community further on this issue, and we welcome additional insights or feedback.
Thanks, Deb. Sanisha, the next two questions are for you, just related to small business. Organization noted USAID has made significant progress with small business contracting goals. Are there targets for hub zones, women-owned small businesses, and economically disadvantaged women-owned small businesses at missions and headquarter bureaus? What steps does USAID plan to take to increase contracting in these areas, and will USAID be issuing any set-asides for these different categories?
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Earlier during my remarks, I mentioned some of the accomplishments that we made as an agency as it relates to the various socioeconomic small business goals. There were notable increases in various in the other areas such as hub zone and service disabled veteran I mentioned earlier. But what we're doing to ensure that we increase our overall support of the programs. Our agency leadership will continue to work with our office, the OSDBU, to facilitate and engage facilitate activities that will help us engage small businesses during the acquisition planning process. prior to conducting market research, we cannot predict if a procurement will be set aside for a specific small business program. However, the OSDBU will continue to work closely with technical staff and contracting officials to identify procurements that may be set aside for small businesses. I just want to also include that although there are no statutory goals associated with economically disadvantaged women-owned small businesses, the agency does definitely include that particular program in its effort to increase awards to women-owned small businesses. Thank you.
Thanks, Nisha. Next question is for you as well. What efforts is USAID undertaking sort of beyond the regular trainings and orientation activities to address some of the inherent perceptions or bias on part of USAID staff that small businesses are not well suited to implement large, complex projects?
Okay, interesting. In October 2019, the agency's newly appointed industry liaison, a member of the Bureau of Management and Office of Acquisition and Assistance, teamed with our office, OSDBU, to enhance partnership engagement materials and activities. In addition, the industry liaison has collaborated with our office and agency leadership to refine a new partnership initiative approach to small businesses, to engaging small businesses. Also, the Bureau of Management has a professional development and training team that works closely with the Small Business Office to train our acquisition staff, which also that training also includes elements of the new partnerships initiative. It is the agency's policy to require annual training for staff involved in acquisition and assistance, and this also includes members of the technical evaluation panels.
Thanks, Tanisha. And I think it's just important to add, obviously, we have the Frankfurt Small Business Conference.
Correct.
We've got staff coming in from the Middle East, Europe and Eurasia, and Africa for 2 days to meet with partners, obviously learn about the work that they're doing. And even the day before that conference starts, there's a small business training for all of the staff that are coming in. So obviously, there's a lot of things we're trying to do to enhance understanding of the capabilities of small businesses. Randy, I want to turn over to you now just to talk about the new partnerships initiative. One of the comments is it appears that USAID's, that under the new partnerships initiative, current U.S.-based partners are receiving funding to provide assistance to local organizations. Can you provide some information on how the partnership structure for U.S. organizations is intended to work under NPI and how those procurement decisions were made to those U.S.-based organizations?
Thank you, Matt, and thank you to everybody for joining today. So they're being asked to contribute to NPI programming. NPI seeks to strengthen in-country capacity to support the journey to self-reliance. Many U.S.-based and international development partners operate locally in partner countries and, we think, deliver impactful development programs, often with significant private or non-U.S. government assistance, but with little or no financial support from USAID, especially in recent years. The agency has determined these organizations are essential to build long-term local capacity and provide services, accountability, and sustainability in the partner countries that we prioritize. In addition, many of our well-established USAID partners that are not local provide essential and effective support in building local capacity, managing compliance, and technical oversight while getting the job done with development outcomes. So, last April, we created a new local partner category, locally established partners, to capture this additional element of local partner capacity building. And we created four modalities of partnership that involve U.S. and international organizations in various ways, either as local partners or as established partners that can provide this capacity building support. So we prioritize these different approaches in the following way. First, direct awards to new and underutilized organizations that include local entities, those indigenous local partners, locally established partners, and U.S. and locally based small businesses. We also have a modality that uses subawards strategically to new and underutilized organizations that are also local, and that's designed to support a more facilitative partnership approach for effective local engagement. We often call these mentoring awards. One good recent example is under the Global Health New Partnerships Initiative, APS, Palladium was the awardee and has a an award which will commit 60% of total funding to sub-awards to strengthen those local partners to lead in implementation and become strengthened through the Prime's assistance. And then finally, direct awards to our traditional partners who are leveraging significant private or non-U.S. government funding to promote effective local engagement. We'll share this on the postings following this call, but I'll just close the answer to this question by saying that we're working closely with agency offices to define problem statements and craft APS or other types of solicitations, and we'll have some of that information posted that provides some background on how this process is unfolding in NPI awards to date and in planned solicitations coming forward.
Thanks, Randy. Next question is for you as well, related to co-creation. It's obviously a big topic with effective partnering and procurement reform and NPI. And the question is, will in-country co-creation processes be standardized going forward?
It's a great question. So the journey to self-reliance requires USAID to become less prescriptive in our awards and solicitations and offer more inclusive opportunities for partners in-country to craft the approach that will meet our strategic imperatives and, as appropriate, define even the agency's objectives in those development programs. So we are committed to host country-driven design, and we appreciate that achieving results and catalyzing sustainable solutions relies on programs that are tailored collaboratively. As a result, I would say that co-creation, especially as realized through an expanding portfolio of mechanisms, cannot ever be truly standardized. In order to elevate best practices around co-creation, we are working especially with our acquisition and assistance labs, which are in every region of the world and Washington, to publish in the spring a co-creation field guide and toolkit, as Mark mentioned earlier, that highlights examples and resources for ANA practitioners. In fulfillment of multiple recommendations under effective partnering and procurement reform and the ANA strategy, MOAA and those ANA labs will support a community of practice and knowledge management platform for contracting and assistance officers and for program staff around the globe to share knowledge and practices around co-creation. So stay tuned for that toolkit and for further policy and guidance around co-creation.
Thanks, Randy. Mark, back to you. It's the question on the selection of instruments, and it's a question related to how USAID can be more transparent on how decisions are made within the selection of instruments.
Thanks, Matt. I think as many of you know, we've really dedicated significant efforts over the last several years to try to improve acquisition and assistance determinations. We've issued amplifying guidance as well as advanced policy clarity in this area on selection of instruments and tools related to it. I think all of you know as well, and as part of the effective partnering and procurement reform effort, we've also been advancing on the assistance side the use of concept papers. On the acquisition side, we've been trying to advance more statement of objectives. We're also working, as Randy and others have noted this morning, on co-creation and collaborative processes. On the acquisition side, we're also working on additional guidance on phased or two-step procurements. I think many of you are familiar with mandatory and voluntary down select that is possible to be utilized. At the end of the day, we are trying to find ways for all of the partners to become more involved early on and engaged in the process, early in the design and the solicitation process. We're hopeful that the more successful we are in this space, the less concerns and issues that will arise on selection of instruments. I'm not going to go into the full details as far as I think many of you are familiar with the current ADS 304, selecting the appropriate acquisition and assistance instruments. You're also familiar with the Federal Grant and Cooperative Agreement Act guidance that implements as well, and obviously those are our traditional areas of policy and that we utilize in our selection of instrument guidance.
Thanks, Mark. And we In our sort of transcript of this call, we will have a lot more of that detailed information that you mentioned about the ADS 304 policy and the Federal Grant and Cooperative Agreement Act. So this is the last question for our call today. But Randy, this is a question for you. You mentioned sort of the new definition of locally established partners. Can you provide some examples of what it would take to fulfill requirements for eligibility to bid on work as a locally established partner? And then the second part of that question is whether or not they might partners might expect procurements restricted specifically to local entities or to restricted to locally established partners.
Thank you, Matt. So we do expect many solicitations to target both types of local partners, and that has been an expectation under the NPI pilot phase. But we also have programs that target only local entities. The indigenous local partners, where the context and strategic approach supports that. So local entity is a congressionally authorized definition. Both local entities and locally established partners are now part of our policy in the ADS. And we'll provide the definitions, which have been in the ADS since last April, in the posted response to this webinar. But just briefly, as for the past 10 years or so, a local entity is an individual or organization that is legally organized under the laws of that country, has its principal place of business and operations there, and is majority owned by individuals who are citizens or lawful permanent residents. Now, in contrast, the requirement for a locally established partner to be eligible under that category is a little different. We have we want them to demonstrate continuous operations in country for at least 5 years and materially demonstrate a long-term presence. This includes 50% of the national office staff are local, are nationals. There is a dedicated local office that's registered in some appropriate way, and there's a portfolio of locally implemented programs. In addition, demonstrating links to the local community and through various means. So we will again post this, but we've already done some work under these definitions with the Global Health New Partnerships Initiative, APS. A good example that I might cite here of one of the early awardees as a locally established partner, which is also qualified as a new and underutilized partner, is World Relief, which under a recent award is now implementing in 4 countries on maternal child health programming. Finally, in terms of fulfilling the requirements, typically to date, in the co-creation stage with the submission of a concept note, a locally established partner would self-certify their status. Should the process move forward to a call for applications, the agency will exercise due diligence in order to verify LEP status in accordance with local regulations and practice. And again, through round 2 of the GHNPI, that was targeted specifically to locally established partners. And if you want to see how USAID provided that funding opportunity and clarified those criteria, please refer to the NPI GHAPS Round 2, Expanding Health Partnerships on grants.gov. And that will also be a posted link after this call. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Randy. So those are all the questions that we were going to cover on today's call. I don't know, Mark, if you have any just closing remarks you want to share.
Yeah, I just wanted to note again, as a number of us have noted this morning, that we do very much appreciate these opportunities where you feed us a variety of different questions that you're facing and that are coming up. In any one of these cases, if there is a need or a concern for a deeper dive, we very much appreciate the greater granularity and details of the nature of the situation you're facing and how you're seeing it presented in different missions or here in Washington. We again thank you for your time and participation, both individually and on part of the association. I'd like to thank Matt and Brittany on our communications team. They've done a fabulous job, as usual, with collecting and digesting and assisting in all the logistics and organization of us coming together today. Thankful to Randy, Deb, Tanisha, and again, we really appreciate all the time and effort that has gone into this and your commitments and interest in our agency. So we thank you.
Thanks, Mark. And just to reiterate, we will be posting a recording of the call, transcript of this call, as well as the full list of questions we received on our website, If you do a Google search of Ask the Procurement Executive for USAID, you'll find that link, and we will include it in our newsletter once we send it out, and we'll tweet it out this afternoon once we get everything posted. So thanks again to everyone for participating. We look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thanks.